Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Kim Nash.
Later on Building Bridges, Greg Shotwell from Soldiers of Solidarity talks about fighting the crisis at Delphi Auto Parts. But first,
we have with us business and law editor at the University of Illinois, Mark Ruda. The labor movement has sat by impotently while bankruptcy courts have eviscerated benefits and unions in airlines and steel, and now it's coming to auto. So now you call Steve Miller at the Delphi Corporation the Terminator. Why do you say that?
Steve Miller, who is the CEO of Delphi, just put the company into bankruptcy, has a history of throwing companies into Chapter 11 bankruptcy. He did the same thing, the same technique that we are now seeing unfold at Delphi, in which it's being used to tear up the old union contract and put in terms that are highly disadvantageous to workers. He did this before at Bethlehem Steel Corporation, put Bethlehem Steel into bankruptcy. He's on the board of United Airlines, and he was involved in their bankruptcy. He was the CEO of Federal Mogul, which is another auto parts company that he threw also into bankruptcy in the late 90s. He's called a corporate doctor, but he does the sort of amputations that his employees fear.
I'm trying to restrain myself. How is this all going on? I mean, how is the labor movement, how are we allowing these courts, where do they get their power from, that divest workers
well,
their benefits?
If I could give just a little history, Chapter 11 was first popularized during the Depression, and the idea behind it was that a company gets into a period of bad luck. After all, it's the Depression when they're looking at this, and by allowing it to have a court stay so that its creditors cannot take it over, it can reorganize itself and preserve its assets. The other alternative is Chapter 7, which is the liquidation sales, selling everything that you see on stores. What's happened is that Chapter 11 back in 1978 was liberalized to allow managers, the same managers in most cases that got the company into trouble, to have huge leeway under court protection to reorganize the companies. This in turn encouraged accounting firms and almost all the white shoe law firms to set up thriving bankruptcy practices to help managers tear out union contracts and other things that they didn't like that they had promised in years past. And then another thing that happened in just the last couple years is guess who else came on board, and that was the bankers. Traditionally, the bankers were on the side of the creditors and against the managers in these cases. But the bankers and the managers have formed an alliance in which the bankers give huge loans to the corporations in Chapter 11 to help them in bankruptcy, which gives them even more power. And Delphi is just an amazing case. First of all, was Delphi, the day it went into bankruptcy, it had $1.6 billion in cash on hand. It had lost around $700 million by its own reporting, but it still had a huge amount of cash. In addition, shortly before it went into bankruptcy, it got another $2 billion from Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. So Delphi went into bankruptcy court fortified with a huge, almost $4 billion, and it's raring to fight the union and break the contract. And the bankers are in the background financing this. This is a very recent phenomenon. The great historical precedent was Frank Lorenzo and Eastern Airlines in 1980, where he tried to use Chapter 11 bankruptcy to terminate the pilot's contract. He failed. The first case where Chapter 11 has been used to rearrange and terminate old contracts, to strip away pension and retiree benefits, started in the steel industry, and the major case is the case of Bethlehem Steel and Steve Miller, in which the assets of Bethlehem Steel were first stripped of pension and health care benefits because they petitioned the judge they didn't have the money, and then immediately were the physical assets, the steel mills, were transferred to another very important person in this new phenomenon, Wilbur Ross, the New York financier. And he took over Bethlehem Steel and other companies and has since sold those companies to Middle Steel of Netherlands. And as I report in my various web and other reporting, Wilbur and his associate made a cool $1.1 billion off that deal. They held Bethlehem for 18 months and made $1.1 billion. billion.
So let's return to the present and maybe talk a bit about the future. Delphi is now in bankruptcy. There is threats of layoffs. They may impact General Motors Corporation and send that spiraling down. Tell us what's going on today.
Delphi was the former Delco division of General Motors, and it was spun off from General Motors in 1999. Delphi is the largest auto components company in the world. It makes steering columns, powertrains, the plastic for the interiors of cars. It makes almost all the guts of the cars. Over half its contracts are still with General Motors. It has almost $30 billion in sales. It's an extremely large corporation. What's happening now is that Delphi is using a particular part of Chapter 11, which is called Section 1113. Section 1113 allows a company to petition the bankruptcy judge to terminate a union contract without an agreement with the union for the best interests of the company being under reorganization. On March 31st, Steve Miller started the clock ticking and asked Judge Robert Drain of the bankruptcy court in Manhattan to terminate the contract. There will be hearings before Drain. And what Miller is proposing to the United Auto Workers is that they reduce cash wages from $26 an hour to around $17 an hour. And he also wants to eliminate 20,000 jobs.
I'm so angry. I'm so incensed because we've seen the bankruptcy court now intervene in pension benefits and various
right.
things for minors. We've seen the Delphi. We've seen the airlines. I don't even understand why the organized labor movement hasn't taken this up as a real fundamental issue.
It's actually very sad, Mimi. The United Steel Workers have gone along with all of these transactions, and the reasons for that are very cynical. The reasons for it is, and again, involves the small group of people. Wilbur Ross was the key one. Ross had another very good idea. He went to the head boss of the steel workers named Leo Girard, and he said, look, we will keep exclusive bargaining rights for the steel workers. The steel workers are unable to organize the mini mills, the smaller, more efficient steel mills that are actually doing very, very well in this country. So a deal was made that Bethlehem Steel would remain in the exclusive bargaining for the union. The conditions were rather tough in the case of Bethlehem. 95,000 retirees and widows lost their health benefits. But on the other hand, widows and retirees don't pay union dues.
And this is something that is not just confined to Delphi. You had mentioned some other cases that we will probably be seeing news about in the future. Why don't you give us a short heads up on that?
Everyone is looking at General Motors, and people are wondering whether this assault on the United Auto Workers by Delphi isn't a proxy for breaking the union for General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. People are very unsure. There's all sorts of evidence going various ways whether GM is actually being inconvenienced by Steve Miller, that he's a loose cannon, or if he's doing General Motors' dirty work. The auto component part is a very large industry. I explained in the case of Bethlehem Steel, the financier Ross was on the other end of the bankruptcy court ready to buy them out after all of these employee costs were stripped out, the so-called legacy costs, which is the word that corporate lawyers like to use. Well, Wilbur Ross has raised $4 billion, he's announced, to grab the auto parts industry. And one of his key companies that he wants to buy out of bankruptcy is Delphi. So it's the same gang. So I think once, you know, you find that something like this is so successful that you can take a company like Bethlehem Steel that was losing money, strip out all these costs, and make $1 billion in cold cash in 18 months, that is going to inspire a lot of imitators. So the airline industry is another battleground, but probably Wilbur Ross and others have been now very involved in the coal industry. Wilbur Ross was the owner and actually had financed the company that built the Sago mine. So there's what I think is a relatively small group of people who are very well-versed in bankruptcy law that is using these loopholes. Mimi's question, why the AFL-CIO hasn't brought out the alarms on this, is amazing. The coal workers and some factions of the United Auto Workers have begun talking about Chapter 11, but there's been a kind of a conspiracy of silence among the top union bureaucrats where they don't want to talk about this. But most workers are just unaware that their employer can promise them pensions and health benefits, that they can be signed into a collective bargaining agreement, and they can then walk into bankruptcy court, and those employees become unsecured creditors and can lose absolutely everything. And at the moment, parts of the pensions are guaranteed by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is a federally run agency. But they are now racking up huge deficits that started with Bethlehem Steel and have grown because of United Airlines. At the moment, Delphi has not yet had its pension program thrown through the Pension Guarantee Corporation. If that happens, that agency is liable to face severe problems. So there's a lot of potential for escalation here.
Mark, I know you've got a new book out. Why don't you mention the title of that and how people can get your publications?
Well,
and
thanks, Ken. Yeah, the book that I have out is called Making Steel, Sparrow's Point. What I would like to alert but listeners to is that I have placed a whole series of articles on Delphi, on bankruptcy, on Bethlehem Steel, on a website. It's called MakingSteel.com. And that can provide lots of information to all these different groups about what's happening. It goes into great detail about the things that we're very quickly going over, about Section 1113, about Wilbur Ross, about Steve Miller. And it's, I think, a pretty good font of information. People now are using it, and a lot of people seem to be saying the same things Mimi's saying is, you know, we got to start fighting this. But you can't really fight it unless you, you know, learn a little bit more about what's really going on.
Yeah, sure, and we really want to thank Mark Reuter from University of Illinois. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Greg Shotwell, a member of UAW Local 2151, Delphi Auto Parts at Coopersville, Michigan, and a soldier of solidarity, has a plan to fight Steve Miller's attack on Delphi workers. Shotwell and his comrades in Soldiers of Solidarity are bringing back the shop floor-based militancy of the rank and file on which the union movement was created, but which is so lacking today. He spoke recently at the Labor Notes Conference in Dearborn, Michigan.
Hope is not the wishful notion that someone else is going to save us. Hope is fighting like hell against all odds. When Delphi declared bankruptcy and threatened to cut our wages 60% and dump our pensions, the UAW International said, "We have a plan. We just can't tell you what it is." We couldn't wait to find out. A rank-and-file resistance movement, Soldiers of Solidarity, sprang up from the grassroots. Now, sparks of resistance in the form of solidarity committees are flaring up like brush fires all over the Midwest. We've held meetings and protests in Grand Rapids, Flint, Bay City, Saginaw, Lockport, Milwaukee, Dayton, Kokomo, Troy, Youngstown, Toledo, and Detroit. Offshoot groups inspired by SOS have organized in St. Louis and Peoria. In every meeting, we have asserted this is not just about Delphi. This struggle is a fight for the dignity of all workers. If Delphi is permitted to shelter assets overseas and use bankruptcy courts to break union contracts, dump responsibility for retirees onto taxpayers, all the multinationals will follow suit. Bankruptcy isn't just the latest trend in the land of casino capitalism. It's a union-busting plan. It isn't just about the money. It's about control over the conditions of our labor. It's a battle to determine who will rule the shop floor. If we don't gang up and beat this bully, we will one day hear workers say, "If only the UAW had called a national strike at Delphi, we wouldn't be so weak today." We commonly hear rank-and-file members say a general strike is needed. The rank-and-file doesn't need convincing, they need organizing. The biggest obstacle to the general strike is not worker apathy, it's union bureaucracy. We are not only fighting the Goliath of corporate domination, we are also fighting Goliath's ugly sweetheart, the company union. We are struggling to free ourselves from the harness of a company union partnership and its bridle of destructive accommodation to the corporate agenda. How can we empower our fellow workers? Not with rhetorical slingshots, grand theories, and political pie in the sky, but in the most fundamental way and in the most fundamental place where we live and where we work every day. Sam Gindin once said, "If workers don't believe that change is possible because of their experience in the union day to day, you can forget about politics." If we can empower workers where they live and work every day, then and only then can we organize a real resistance, a real union, a real social movement. Then and only then can we put the backbone back in the UAW. If knowledge is power, what is it that workers know better than anyone? The answer is simple: work. And the conclusion is clear. Work to rule is the fundamental building block of collective action. Work to rule is not a doctrine, it's concerted activity, and it has multiple meanings. First and foremost, work to rule is a method of controlling production, of slowing down, of showing the boss who's boss. The aim is to leverage negotiations and/or prepare for strike or other collective actions. But work to rule is also an invocation, a sort of call and response for broader and more direct confrontation, because it raises workers' consciousness of the power we hold in our hands. The old UAW had a culture of struggle, a tradition of direct action. I remember when I first came into the UAW 27 years ago, I didn't know a lot about unions, but they soon showed me what it meant. 6:30 one morning, we were sitting around drinking coffee and dressing out our grinders, and a foreman who was new to the area came up and said, "Get to work right now, I'm the boss." We said, "Yes, sir, boss," and we went right to work. Within 30 minutes, every machine in that department was down. Skilled trades were called out. They tore the machines apart. They left the parts on the floor. Then they went off to look for replacement parts and never came back. There was no production that day. Every department behind us went down like a domino. The next morning, that same foreman came into the area. He said, "Good morning, gentlemen," and he got the hell out of there. In those days, workers controlled the shop floor. We didn't plan this direct action. We didn't even talk about it. It was automatic. We didn't call it work to rule. We called it, "Let's show him who's boss." That's what the old-timers taught me about unionism. The UAW cut its teeth on slowdowns. The UAW was born in conflict, not collaboration. The new UAW concession caucus, as I call them, intentionally emasculated the militancy of the UAW rank and file. The concession caucus promoted competition between workers and cooperation with the bosses. The concession caucus promoted alienation from workers in other countries and partnership with the company. When the concession caucus promoted Buy American, all they did was provide cover for the corporations to invest our legacy overseas. Instead of promoting international solidarity, they promoted teamwork with the bosses, and we, the workers, are the losers. We don't need collaborators. We need soldiers of solidarity who are willing to defend their turf, soldiers who believe that we are worth fighting for. When workers work to rule, they assert the power of their knowledge and skill over the means of production and its owners. When workers work to rule, human rights takes precedent over property rights. We can't begin to organize a general strike or even an industry-wide strike until workers actually experience firsthand the power of concerted activity on the shop floor. Work to rule is not simply a method of slowing production. Work to Rule is a network of communication, a coded language of subversion. I don't tell workers to slow down. I say, give them what they deserve. Break the record. Working to Rule is an underground network of communication, a network above and beyond, below and around the control of the company or the official union. Last February, a protest was planned at a Delphi plant in Flint. But the night before, the local union officials called it off on account of rain. SOS went on alert via internet and cell phone. Our message was, soldiers of solidarity won't melt in the rain. We showed up. We picketed the plant and we dominated the media, the radio, the television, the national newspapers with our message. SOS is ready to strike. SOS won't back down. Soldiers of solidarity don't melt in the rain. You can bet the rank and file took note of the difference between soldiers of solidarity and local union officials. Work to Rule is also about workers exerting their power in their own union. When I went to Lockport, New York, some workers asked me how to make a motion at a union meeting. And I thought to myself, oh, we are very far down the learning curve here. But the next meeting, they went in with a plan and passed motions for full disclosure of all changes in the contract and at least a week between the information meeting and the ratification meeting. The importance of that action was that they took control of the union meeting from the floor, not from the podium. On March 31st, a supervisor informed Claudia Perkins at the Delphi plant in Flint that she was laid off. "You must be out of your mind. I will be to work on Monday." She called her bargaining chair and asked if he was aware her seniority rights were being violated. He admitted that he was aware of it, but said, "You know, I called the International and they haven't called back yet." She said, "Do you know how to write a grievance? Because I know how to sign one, and I will hit the clock on Monday." Even the most sluggish of bureaucrats can recognize a train that isn't going to stop. On Monday, Claudia and 40 other workers who had been laid off showed up and sat down. They got their jobs back. The civil rights movement wasn't organized from on high. The March on Washington was built step by step by a woman who said, "I'm not giving up my seat." By young men who sat at lunch counters and endured physical, emotional, and psychological abuse. By an old woman who, after a long day at work, said, "I'd rather walk than take that bus." Those people led us to Washington in 1963. Those small but enormously courageous actions were the building blocks of the civil rights movement. Our goal in Soldiers of Solidarity is long-term and far broader than one plant or one company or one union. This isn't just about Delphi. Delphi is the harbinger. The vulture capitalists want to steal our pensions, cut our wages, slash benefits, and bust unions across the board. They won't be satisfied to stop at Delphi. Delphi is just a donut shop on the highway to Armageddon. SOS advocates that workers in all sectors assert their power at the point of production. Stoke the brush fires and reinforce the rank and file network of communication as a first step in the process of broad collective actions that directly confront Goliath and his ugly sweetheart and their government bodyguard. The fact is, we do occupy the plants, the offices, the roads, the ships, the airways every day. We've established our beachhead, but a general strike will not be organized from the top down. A general strike can only be organized from the ground up. Work to Rule is the building block. Work to Rule raises the individual worker's awareness of his or her power to control production and inflict maximum damage where it counts the most, the bottom line. Work to Rule fosters and reinforces the network of communication, the bonds of solidarity needed for broader collective action. Work to Rule is about controlling the work, the conditions of our labor. When I am asked, what can we do to support Delphi workers? I say, organize your own workplace, your own neighborhood. Because Delphi isn't just a company name, it's a code name for a SWAT team coming to you on a fast train. The workplace, not the bargaining table, is the real battleground. We can't beat Goliath in the courts. We can't beat Goliath in the back room. We won't beat Goliath in the election booth until we beat that bully on the shop floor. SOS is a rank-and-file movement. SOS doesn't believe that if we elect a hero, he will save us. We are not hero worshipers. We understand that real unionism springs from the bottom up and dies from the top down. We do not advocate replacing one puppet with another puppet. Changing the guards won't change the prison. SOS advocates that workers themselves become the leaders we have always been looking for, and that we lead from the ground floor, not from the top floor. My old friend Dave Yetoff said, you can defeat a leader, but you can't defeat an idea. To which I might add, you can defeat a leader, but you can't defeat the rank and file when they lead the battle. Workers will rule when they work to rule.
You've been listening to Greg Shotwell on Fighting Back Against Delphi, the auto parts giant which seeks to use bankruptcy laws to bankrupt Delphi workers and retirees. For more information about the struggle, go to futureoftheunion.com.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.